Welcome to a discussion on a Radio IQ news story brought to you by the Roanoke Collaboration Project and Radio Melrose.
In 2024, record funds were approved to support Virginia's developmentally disabled community, but changes to federal funding and an agreement with the Department of Justice may require more state funds to be spent in 2026. Tanya Milling is with the ARC of Virginia. She said Governor Glenn Youngkin failed to include funds for rate increases for some services, including personal care, nursing, and respite, in his outgoing budget.
Services that make it possible, make community life possible for people with disabilities who have the highest, most complex support needs.
A long-running agreement with the DOJ following decades of the Commonwealth's poor treatment of people with disabilities made concrete demands in these areas last year. A federal judge in Richmond is set to hear more from Youngkin and advocates at a hearing Wednesday. The funding issue comes as a recent report on the state's Medicaid spending suggests a $3.2 billion shortfall over the next 3 years. But there's one option ARC thinks could see funds put back into state coffers even while their community asks for more, expanding an exception that allows those receiving benefits to work more, paying taxes into the system that also supports them. Lucy Beadneal is with the ARC of Northern Virginia. She said an increase in minimum wage is already impacting her members. If they make too much money, they lose federal benefits.
We have a lot of folks who have started to say, if there's three Friday paydays in a month, I have to call up the last week. And we further disable people when we say, no, sit home and do nothing.
Virginia's legislature, backed by Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger, will use Youngkin's budget as a starting point when they return to Richmond for the 2026 session starting next week. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Hello, welcome to a discussion about the story you just heard by the Roanoke Collaboration Project. I'm William Fralin, a former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
I'm Dana Ackley, author of A Little Book to Save Humanity.
I'm Cynthia Lawrence. I'm the Director of Workforce Development at Carilion Clinic.
And I'm Catherine Elam, the former Director of Junior Achievement of Southwest Virginia.
I'm Joyce Waugh, former President of the Roanoke Regional Chamber of Commerce.
Wayne Strickland, former Executive Director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
I am Michael Brockta, CIA retired and past president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
Well, welcome, Michael. I think this might be your first show in the CIA, so you're an ex-federal employee, so you can help us with the state-federal interaction here. So there is a question about how we're going to fund the Medicaid budget, and I think the story reflects one piece of that. It's a broader, probably, discussion that we can have. But what are y'all's thoughts about the necessity of that funding and really where it stands?
Well, from my perspective, looking at it from a caregiver's lens, by decreasing funds for aides or other care providers, it puts a real strain on the families. And if there are working adults in the family that need to go to work but yet are struggling to care for someone with acute needs, this is a real hardship. So we're going to have to think through this.
So it could be we're losing tax revenues because people aren't working. I think that's what the ARC spokesperson was talking about, is if we arbitrarily cut benefits when people are actually starting to get on their feet, it might end up costing us more in the long run, maybe.
Agreed. And I do think that, you know, this is a population that is far more vulnerable, you know, than maybe the average citizen. And, what does that say about us and our community, our Commonwealth?
Right. Michael?
When you look at the demographics here in Roanoke, you see there's a disproportionate number of families who are operating at the financial edge. And it doesn't take much, perhaps this could do it, to push them over that edge. So this particular topic, I think, ought to resonate heavily with our Roanoke Valley population.
I think you're probably right. And the work requirements, you know, that are in the legislation, it sounds like, for the ARC population is would be something that would probably appeal to most people, and that people are getting out and working for it, and so therefore to cut that arbitrarily might be a problem. Cynthia, I think you were talking about the ice cream store. Help me.
Well, yes, actually, there's a nonprofit in our area in the valley called Chris's Custard, and the Woodrum family is supporting an endeavor to employ individuals who have Down syndrome or other developmental disabilities to learn a skill and a trade. And I think that is providing a really valuable community service, bringing pleasure, of course, to a neighborhood, but also creating an ecosystem in and of itself for self-supporting avenues that could help augment and maybe bolster the argument for restoring some funding so that individuals can be more productive.
Right, because everyone's looking for more workers you know, they're getting harder and harder to find. And Chris's Coffee and Custard. And I like the nonprofit, I may be wrong on this, is actually called Lovable Services, which I adore. You know, but think of how much better people feel when they're working. Right. You know, they're giving back. They're not just taking, if you will. And people with this population especially, I think, they don't get that chance every day.
Catherine?
I'm wondering also what this impacts in terms of our school systems. We have a lot of people that have been hired to help people with disabilities as well, to help these young people have that inspiration while they're in school and then going to look for these jobs and being at Chris's Custard and other places like that, because that's what we want all of our young people to be able to be in a position to look at how they can be somewhat self-sustaining and at least help a lot of the families, as we just said, need that additional income as well when they're dealing with those problems.
Well, let me add on to that a little bit, Catherine. Because there is, and you probably know this better than I, but there is an age limit at which the school systems then stop supporting those students, and it's incumbent upon families and employers to help those young adults transition into a productive working environment. Carilion Clinic is very active in that space. It's expensive.
And you're speaking of folks that have intellectual disabilities in particular?
That's right? Correct. Right. That's right. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Wayne?
Well, I mean, for the longest time, we put our disabled folks off to the side and didn't pay attention to them and said, you know, bless their hearts, and maybe we'll give them money to try to, you know, continue on. But I think having them contribute is so important. And the fact that we can, you know, train them to do so many different things will help the businesses in our area. The business could be more profitable, and of course our folks who are disabled would be contributing more and feel much better about the work that they're doing.
Right. And just for our listeners, the governor's budget, the way the process works, the governor introduces a budget. We'll have a new governor in January, and the General Assembly will work its will on that budget. Mm-hmm. So it will look very different from what is introduced. The story pointed out there was not money in the budget for this. That's just so our listeners know, that's not the end of the story. But it does lead to the question, whose responsibility? The federal government, the state government, the local government? Where does this money come from? We're already at, from what the story said, we're already at a $3.2 billion deficit that is going to have to be covered. And are we going to be able to do all the things that we want to do with that?
I frankly wouldn't care to have the guy's job who makes those decisions.
Right.
Right.
And they're easily criticized, and we probably can't do everything that we would like to do. But the decisions that are made and that we allow to be made, that we vote for being made, reflect the values that we bring. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to speak a little more loudly about what the values are that we want our government to endorse, but not just the government, but our business community as well.
Right, right. Michael?
You know, I'd like to offer the idea that solutions to address this problem don't necessarily have to come exclusively from the government or the business community. And I'm now speaking as a member of that Kiwanis Club that I've been active in. We're one of many civic organizations in the Roanoke Valley. Our valley is blessed with so many groups focused on helping the underserved. And so we're trying to step up in the way we can to do our little small piece. I just wonder if this is going to be a call to action to other nonprofits and civic groups who are in a similar place where they can help.
Right, sort of to, like Cynthia was talking about, the name of the place was
Chris's Custard.
Chris's Custard. Yeah. Sort of like that. I mean, that's what a great story that is. And I'm sure they decided, the Woodrums decided to do that, not because there was a program they could fulfill, but they decided to do that, and then the program helped them. So,
well, and to
go ahead, Joyce.
To Mike's point, I think that, you know, a lot of churches are also in that boat. And they're doing the same kind of things, you know, and how much more can and will perhaps they be called upon to step up.
Right, right. Michael?
I'll follow up with that, Joyce. We have a limited capacity. The Kiwanis Club may be the largest civic organization in the Valley, but it's got a limited capacity. Hmm. I mean, we took in more money this year than ever before, and we've turned around and handed out more grant money than ever before. But still, that's a drop in the bucket. Who's filling in the rest of that bucket?
Right. And if we're, I guess the question might be, if we're going to have a social safety net, do we need the government to be the final backstop of that? Or do we rely on foundations and charity as in good ideas?
Well, I think it's not binary. that it isn't either or. And too often these decisions seem to get made in a binary way. And for example, the way we think about disabled people, either they can or they can't. Well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Often they can work very well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think you've just articulated the call to action very well in that, you know, civic engagement and all of us working together are going to have to weave together the solutions that we need that are unique to each situation. It's up to each of us to say, what can I do? What can the organization that I belong to do? And that's the beauty of the community that we live in and the society that we live in here.
Michael?
Think for a moment about the challenges that these people have who are seeking help, who are needing help. Even though we're in a valley with a rich fabric of social support systems and networks, it's a quagmire from the standpoint of the person who's new here, who needs help here. They don't know how to navigate it. Perhaps we can step up and have the resources, but how do the people in need find or get access to those resources?
Thank you. Just to remind everybody, you're listening to a discussion brought to you by Radio Melrose on a story by WVTF, and thank you for listening.
I think that, Wayne, as Mike said, and as Cynthia said, we need to work together. It can't be all government because government changes, and the leadership in government changes, and therefore levels of interest change. So if we can find a way to incentivize the nonprofits and others, or churches and others, to try to jump on board and support the disabled folks and find a better way to do it than what we've been doing.
Well, and as a former head of the Fifth District Planning Commission, which is not the right name. What's the right name?
Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Okay, you've got some experience with program sustainability, and yes. And how that looks over a 1, 3, 5, 10 year period, right?
Right, and the name of this group is the Regional Cooperation Project.
Right,
a cooperation project. So that's what we were doing. We were bringing local governments together and focusing on key issues that affect more than just one place. And I think that would be a great opportunity to bring local governments together to have this conversation. And it could be, certainly, they could work with the state government and federal government to see what's the best way we can address this issue.
Right. Catherine?
Well, I always remember that we have to go back and look at the families who live with these individuals in their household, and they want to make the best for them. And I think so often we feel like all the other entities have all the answers, but we need to be able to listen and make sure those family members get a say in what goes on in the community. I go back a while where we had people who had concerns with water and wastewater in their homes, and we thought we had all the solutions for it. And we brought it to them, and they didn't have a clue how to use it or what to do with it. So I think a lot of times we're quick to give answers, but are we listening to the people who are really being impacted by that? So I think a lot of times, even though we have all these wonderful resources, are we taking time to hear the people who have to live that life daily?
Very good point. Dana?
To support what you're saying, often experts and professionals think, well, I do have all the answers, but they need to work in partnerships because the families of folks who are disabled are experts as well. They simply see it from a different perspective. And if that isn't appreciated, the plans don't work.
Exactly.
Fair enough. Joyce?
Well, and going back to the story, you know, I don't think government should be off the hook on this, but to your point, maybe, you know, whether the backstop or, you know, in this case, drawing back on the funding, I really think that where it's been effective, for example, for business and economic development is when, you know, the government puts up something and then it is matched or, you know, overmatched, if you will, to make something happen, and then it keeps on going once it's the train is moving, if you will.
Right. You know, and it strikes me, I don't know if anybody in this discussion has any insight on this, but the Melrose Plaza, you know, with the Goodwill Industries, they would probably have a pretty significant viewpoint on this particular issue of funding. Yes, Michael?
I want to follow up on your Melrose Plaza comment. That plaza's been a number of years in the making, and it's not a surprise to those of us who have been following along. It turns out that's why our Kiwanis Club invested heavily in that plaza. Next to it's a playground we built and donated to the city. Now there's a nature park being built and will be donated to the city. So the point I'm making is, if we can get enough lead time on some of these critical issues, maybe one of which is funding, then we can step up to help. Mm-hmm. But it took us a lot of years to get into the playing field on that one. We're not a quick reaction organization, and I don't know how many of our nonprofits, et cetera, are quick reaction organizations. So to have budgets fluctuating left and right, and I mean that in a political sense, on a frequent basis is really difficult to keep up with.
Right, and it strikes me there's really maybe a couple issues here. One's a community response and a group effort to create a space like Melrose Plaza. One strikes me as what Catherine was talking about, an individual family struggling with one or two people with intellectual disabilities. They need help now. They you know, like tomorrow. And the uncertainty that something like this create can might, I would think, create some anxiety, perhaps. Wayne?
One of the things I heard in the report that was up earlier, that they have a work requirement as a part of this. Now, the key was that if you make too much money, then you may not get all the benefit. And it seems odd to me that you know, we have a certain place at that point in your income that you don't get anything else. I mean, if it's a dollar over that threshold, you don't get anything else. And you're better off staying in another, you know, with something else and perhaps get more resources. There's got to be a better way to work that.
Right, and the questioning what the incentives are, and are we designing a program with perverse incentives in the sense that it penalizes people that are trying harder,
so Dana? It depends in part. These decisions depend in part on how you think about folks. If you think folks are basically lazy, then you're going to make these perverse disincentives. If you have a more accurate view of people want to work. People feel successful when they're working. They feel better when they're working. And perhaps if we used a different mental model about how we envision folks who are disabled, we'd make better decisions.
Michael?
You know, I'm thinking about this from a business or financial standpoint. These decisions that are being made or possibly are going to be made are, at the end of the day, financial decisions that have an impact on business. In other words, is it a short-term impact that we're thinking about or a long-term? If we're looking at a long-term view, then we'll look at the life cycle cost of reducing funds for this part of our population, and we'll look at the life cycle cost of the expense that the population and the community will now have to deal with. It may be cheaper up front to invest a little money in a family or a community, and it pays off financially in the long run.
But too often, Dana. You know, if I'm a politician, I've got to win the next election. Mm-hmm. If I'm a CEO, I've got to pay attention to my earnings this next quarter. And that's another set of perverse incentives that lead us to stupid short-term thinking.
Dana, I want to agree with you in spades. It's the choice that I see being forced on people between short-term self-interest,
yes,
and long-term community good.
Mm-hmm. Do we see a difference between somebody that's intellectually disabled and somebody that's not intellectually disabled but is struggling? Is there a difference there?
Say more about what you're thinking.
Somebody that has the capacity to work, that is not limited intellectually, but maybe having difficulty finding a job or finding the job they want. Is our willingness to help that person the same?
I would like to make a comment that I think possibly the person we think cannot get out to work but has the intellectual ability, a lot of the other factors are into that. Are they looking for childcare? Do they have transportation? Those are some real hurdles in our area when it comes to getting a job. A lot of them want to get there, but they have other things that are extenuating that are preventing them from being able to do and hold that job. And when I look at the comparison of some of those individuals,
right.
So where's the support system? How are they going to get about to do what they need to do? Are they able to go for the hours of training they need to have underway? So there are other circumstances we're not aware of.
I'm not advocating here. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate a little bit, but is that the government's problem?
I will say sometimes because of the way the rules are written. Okay. They've got to go along with certain things to be able to get that job, and if they're not able to overcome it or understand how to get the resources, it can be a challenge in some of our communities to be able to get access to that. I mean, the best example I can think of is particularly when we did the COVID. A lot of people didn't have computers. They needed to go online. And I heard the other day, I was somewhere else, where a gentleman said, I want to apply for a job, but everything tells me I have to go online. I don't have the skills to do that. And he'd been a laborer. But he said, I'll do anything you tell me to do. I just don't have the access to a computer to get there and get the job
done. It's a great example of a barrier that we should be able to help with. Comes to mind that libraries have computers that might do it, but I don't know. Michael, you want to say something?
Well, I want to thank you for that brilliant set of examples. This is a case of where, the way I see it, if we invest a little bit in, let's say, the child care or the transportation issue, which is preventing someone from being gainfully employed, then we've paid off in the long run. There's a big contribution that individual is going to make to our local economy once they get to the job. So I, for one, am willing to make that investment. If I'm in a position of authority, I would make that investment knowing that there's going to be economic payback to the community.
And Mike, good news in that employers are now thinking that way en masse. So there's many, many discussions happening in various forums, workforce and education forums, at the local and state levels on addressing those wraparound service needs to support the workforce that we need to be productive.
Wayne?
Yeah, Mike had a good point just a minute ago. There are people who have needs, but they don't know where to go. And I think that's if you talk to folks throughout the region and ask them what if they knew about this or they knew about this program, they'd say, I have never heard of that. And I don't know how you do it, because sometimes we put the information in the newspaper and that doesn't make it, or we put the information on radio and that doesn't make it. I don't know how you disseminate that kind of the info they need to make sure that they can cover up.
And again, playing devil's advocate, we have a whole Department of Social Services that's funded by taxpayer money that's supposed to do that, right?
Right. Well, but that's the point is, they don't know to go to social services.
Okay.
That's it. I think they do the best they can, but it's a patchwork situation. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a one-source-fits-all. So it's such a challenge for someone in need to find the proper avenue, even though they get assistance from social services.
Right, yeah, and make no mistake, again, I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here. I recognize the struggles, but there seems to me there is a line between government collective responsibility and individual responsibility. It's somewhere in there, the problem is it's probably not the same for every person. It's multifactorial, as Catherine pointed out. And it's hard to judge from the outside whether somebody's acting in good faith. Dana?
I think that those who design systems underestimate how difficult it is for people who don't do that every day to work the system.
Fair point. Joyce?
And I'd just like to add that, all of our conversations and all these challenges and wraparound services and all these things, it just points out that there isn't an easy solution when it's a difficult problem.
Right.
And, it's going to take everyone and all kinds of folks to, try to make make it work.
Okay, Dana?
If we're not going to invest in folks who are having difficulties, what are we going to invest in?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a fair question. And this specific story is about people, and the reason I was trying to make the differential, this is about people that through no fault of their own are intellectually disabled. And so there's not it sort of takes away that individual responsibility piece and decision-making piece. And when people make poor decisions and then the results in problems, who's to solve those problems?
Going to say, historically, if you look at this, go back 20, 25 years in the workplace, we didn't have handicap accessible doors. We didn't have the ramp or your curbs where they've dipped down so you can get around. So all of that took a lot of time, but it's a part of our workplace now. I mean, a lot of us understand that. So we have taken a lot of steps. It just took a long time to get there, and it's become a part of the norm. But what else do we need to be doing and looking at that? And so I think about all the designs that have changed from 25 years ago in the workplace.
Now, that's a very fair point. In the Americans with Disabilities Act, I remember, I think it was President Bush, the first, is when that came into being. And we've spent literally probably trillions of dollars in improving our physical plants to the point where, I mean, I'm sure we're not where we would like to be, but it's if you compare where we were in 1982 or 1985 versus where we are in 2025, accessibility is much better. And to what Wayne was talking about, sometimes our program, you know, a long term, it takes a long time to fix some of this stuff. So,
well, another element.
All right, Dana, go for it.
Another element, if we're going beyond the intellectually folks who are intellectually disabled, is that people who grow up in economically disadvantaged situations often don't have any role models to show what can be done, and so they follow what they see, and they don't recognize what they could do if they only had the chance or someone who might give them the chance and believe in them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, and that input, like you were talking about earlier, that input from a government or even a programmatic, you know, trying to start a program and you think you know what's going to help and you're trying to be helpful, but do you really know if you haven't lived it, if you're not having that experience too? Michael?
You know, when I listen to us talking about this today, I'm really not hearing anything new. I'm hearing perhaps it will get worse or at least different, but not necessarily new. So does that suggest the community already knows the approaches that work and don't work?
And if so, what gets in the way of using what works?
Well, and speaking with a little bit of background in government, I mean, oftentimes that is true. And then the question is, all right, who pays, right? Is it the federal government grant? Is it the state that's going to pay? Is it the local Department of Social Services? Are we going to rely on the private sector? And that's where things start getting complicated.
Whose responsibility is it?
Yeah, I think most people would agree, and we're the collaboration project, so most people would agree that it's all of our responsibility.
Right.
The question is, how is that manifest? Is it manifest through tax dollars? Is it manifest through private dollars? Is it manifest through local or state or national programs? And in my experience in government, has been when everybody's in charge, nobody's in charge.
Exactly. Well, I'll reiterate the concept of community. And I think to your comment a minute ago, seeing examples, Dana, people living in community who may be overcoming challenges and having role models and looking at ways to model success, I think can breed creativity and the dynamism to go after resources that may not be readily identifiable.
Right.
So I think, again, we work together.
There is an organization that we've had some experience with in the past called Humble Hustle. Mm-hmm. And they are in the business of providing role models to people who badly need them.
Yeah. Right, right. Good point. Well, we'll close on that point, Dana. That's a very good point. We all know about that organization. They do a very good job. So I want to thank our listeners for joining us for this discussion. It was brought to you by the Roanoke Collaboration Project and Radio Melrose, and we hope you will tune in next time. Oh, I forgot the website.
You forgot the website.